Howdy, friends. You're listening to How the West Was Cast, a podcast dedicated to the best of the Western movie genre.
You hold on a minute, Verge.
Hold on, nothing. I walk around this town and look these people in the eye, and it's just like someone slapping me in the face. These people are afraid to walk down the street, and I'm trying to make money off that like some goddamn vulture. If we're gonna have a future in this town, it's gotta have some law and order.
Please, Verge, don't do this to me.
It's got nothing to do with you, Wyatt. It's got to
do with... Nothing to do with me. I'm your brother, for Christ's sake. God, I don't believe this. Talk to him, will you, or hit him?
That was a scene from the 1993 modern classic Tombstone, which is one of many films you'll hear about on this episode of How the West Was Cast. Hello, my name is Matthew Chernoff, and I'm a screenwriter and an entertainment journalist in Los Angeles.
And I'm Andrew Patrick Nelson, a film historian and the chair of the Department of Film and Media Arts at the University of Utah.
Now, every year, a new assortment of Western film-related books hit the shelves. And if you're a listener of this podcast, well, chances are you've got a decent-sized collection of Western film books on your shelves at home. I know Andrew and I definitely do. So for this episode, rather than focus on one particular movie or subgenre, we're instead going to highlight two recent Western film books that we recommend. And to do that, we're bringing you interviews with both authors. First, you'll hear Andrew's chat with author Henry C. Park about his brand new book, The Greatest Westerns Ever Made, and the people who made them. In addition to writing the book, Henry is also the film and TV editor at True West Magazine. And right after that, you'll hear my interview with author and game designer Corey Everett about his charming new children's book titled My First Spaghetti Western. Together, we think these two very different books help illustrate the wonderful elasticity of the genre itself, and we hope that you enjoy listening to both interviews. But first, we want to take just a few minutes to recommend some other Western film-related books that we also think are well worth recommending. So, Andrew, you have three titles on your list that you want to mention first. So why don't you go through them right now and give us just a snapshot of each book and why you chose it?
Sure thing. So as Matt said, I have a very large bookcase of Western film and television related materials. So picking just three is tough, but here's what I went with. My first choice is 100 Westerns by Edward Buscombe. This is part of the BFI Screen Guides series. Listeners of the podcast will probably be familiar with Ed Buscombe. He is, in my estimation, the greatest scholar of the Westerns. He edited the BFI Companion to the Western. He wrote a little book that I've mentioned a few times on the podcast called Injuns, which is a great study of the representation of American Indians in popular culture. So this book, 100 Westerns, is what it sounds like. It's a short book that offers introductions to 100 Westerns, from across the wide Missouri all the way to Yellow Sky. It's an eclectic selection of both canonical and non-canonical works, as well as some that are considered by someone like me to be Western adjacent. The point isn't to offer a necessarily comprehensive introduction to the Western, but just to provide a starting place where you might be able to go to get some ideas about new Westerns to watch. Each film title that Ed talks about includes a short and quite perceptive little essay. So if you're looking for a list of Westerns to bolster your own Western knowledge, or if you're looking to recommend films for people to start with the genre, this is my go-to book. So 100 Westerns by Ed Buscombe. My second book is Once Upon a Time in Italy, The Westerns of Sergio Leone by Christopher Frayling. Now, Frayling is a pioneer. He was the first English academic to publish about spaghetti Western seriously in the course of a series of articles and then books. So he has a more academic book about Italian Westerns. It was published in the early 1980s. He has written a comprehensive biography of Sergio Leone, which is excellent, and I would encourage listeners of the podcast to check out. It is a bit of a doorstop, though. This book is different. It's lavishly illustrated, and it includes information about all of Leone's Westerns, as well as all of the people who helped to make them. Can't recommend this book highly enough. It's a beautiful book and would be excellent on any Western fan's coffee table. And then finally, and this is me feeling bad about things that we haven't got a chance to talk about yet. I've mentioned a few times that I feel bad about not having really delved into silent Westerns yet, and I know we'll remedy that at some point. But another area that I can't claim to be an expert on, but is nevertheless a vital part of the Western's history, is the singing cowboy film. So my third recommendation is Horse Opera, The Strange History of the 1930s Singing Cowboy by Peter Stanfield. This is a somewhat more academic book, but it is nevertheless enthusiastic, energetic in its exploration of this very uniquely Western phenomena of the singing cowboy from Gene Autry all the way down. So that covers most of the bases and also makes me feel not as bad about not covering some things on the podcast. What about you, Matt? What three books are top of mind to recommend to our readers?
So I've got two biographies and a coffee table book. I'm going to start off with one of my all-time favorite biographies, John Wayne, The Life and Legend. Now, this is a very recent biography. It was published in 2014 by Simon & Schuster. And the book is written by Scott Iman, who also wrote a bio right around that same time of John Ford, titled Print the Legend, The Life and Times of John Ford. I haven't read that one, but I've read the John Wayne book twice so far from cover to cover. It's almost 700 pages, and yet it moves very, very quickly. It's a comprehensive book. It doesn't have a lot of maybe analysis in there, but it gives you such a vivid portrait of Wayne's life from his grandparents to the years after his death and his impact on film and his family. It's a powerful book. It's one of those books that I keep going back to every time I see people denigrate his work as an actor or his personality or sort of take Wayne apart. He's such a controversial figure still today. And when I hear those glib put-downs of him from people who've barely know anything about him, if maybe you just have an impression from articles they've read or headlines they've seen or stories they've heard, this book puts all of that to rest. I mean, it paints him as a hugely complex, challenging guy. There was another one written a few months later titled John Wayne, American Titan by Mark Elliott, a competing Wayne bio released within the same year, and it is just not up to par. It adds a lot more of that type of analysis that Iman doesn't really put in there. And I don't really care too much what Mark Elliott has to say about Wayne and his the way he sort of takes him apart. Are you familiar with that book at all, Andrew?
I've read both. I'm likewise a big fan of Scott Iman's book. I think it's the best Wayne bio. You know, I guess it came out at a time when one might have asked, do we really need another John Wayne biography? And the answer was yes. He wrote it with the cooperation of Wayne's family. He talks to a broad range of people who knew Wayne. And I agree, it is a balanced portrayal of Wayne. What I would especially recommend for folks who haven't checked it out, who might be inclined to listen to audiobooks, is to listen to the audiobook. I do not know the name of the gentleman who reads the book, and we can put that in the show notes. But he does a phenomenal Wayne voice.
Does he?
So it's really a pleasure to listen to because there are moments where it sounds like when it's Wayne being quoted that it's Wayne talking to you.
Oh, how neat.
So that would be my added plug. As for the Elliott, I'm likewise not a huge fan of it. It's a different type of book though. It's a more critical biography and it's a more political biography of Wayne in many respects. And there's space for more political biographies of filmmakers and actors, certainly, but not one of my favorites. But, you know, for the curious listener, it probably worth checking out, especially in comparison to Iman, to see that, you know, one man's life can be written in very different ways.
Now, my second biography is Bloody Sam, The Life and Films of Sam Peckinpah by Marshall Fine. Now, this was published in 1991. It's the first Sam Peckinpah biography. There was one released a few years later by film critic David Weddle called If They Move, Kill 'Em, The Life and Times of Sam Peckinpah. Now, that is an acclaimed book. It's a very powerful book, more similar to the Scott Eyman's John Wayne book. I think most people consider it one of the definitive Peck and Paul bios. But I went with Bloody Sam just because it was the first one. And I vividly remember picking it up on a bookshelf at the Brown University bookstore when it was just hit the shelves. And I couldn't believe that there was finally a biography of Peck and Paul. And it was a decent sized book. So I devoured that thing. Bloody Sam is a personal favorite for me, and the fact that it really got the ball rolling tells a lot. It's a tragic book. The portrait he paints of Peck and Paw, especially towards the end, is kind of harrowing at times. You just read it and cringe at the mistakes he was making, the influence of alcohol in his life and drugs. And I mean, it was just a complete mess. It's a cautionary tale, but he also captures Peck and Paw's poetic side throughout it as well. So you see the portrait of the doomed artist who had a soul of a poet but lived like a cowboy. The Peck and Paw we meet in Bloody Sam has stayed with me a lot. Have you read that one at all?
I have not. I've read The Weddle, but I have not read this particular volume, though on your recommendation, I'm intrigued to. So I'm going to track down a used copy of it somewhere.
Yeah, it was out of print for years. And then it, I think somebody's republished. I haven't looked. Maybe we can put that in the show notes as well. There was a recent paperback reissue, a new cover, looked like somebody had finally put it out there again. So hopefully people will check it out. The Weddle is also equally recommended. And my last choice is a coffee table book, like I mentioned, titled Hang 'em High, 110 Years of Western Movie Posters by Mark Fertig. This is a gorgeous, large-size coffee table book that you can just get lost in reading. It is just beautiful. I mean, you look at this and you're going to break out your wallet trying to buy some of these posters. They are gorgeously displayed. The commentary throughout the book is really expert. In fact, I was so impressed with the book that I reached out to the author because I thought, we got to have this guy on the show. We need to do a full episode on the greatest Western movie posters. And unfortunately, he had died a few weeks before I was ready to reach out to him. So, you know, I'm still thinking about that topic as a possible show we might do one day. Maybe we can bring in an artist or a graphic designer of some type who works on Western film posters or book covers to talk about some, because there's a lot to say about the way Western films have been advertised since the very beginning. Have you checked out Hang 'em High?
I have not, so I'm sorry I missed that, although I remember you mentioning it to me. I have it on order from Amazon, so I look forward to getting lost. And I agree, there's a lot to say about Western movie posters and how, you know, Westerns in particular were advertised, but also just the historical perspective on how movies used to be advertised visually, the types of language that was used, the degree to which a star was or was not emphasized. I mean, it's pretty amazing to delve into that history. So I think that would be a dynamite topic for a future episode. That, and I guess we should probably do our Christmas gift guide, or next time we get into the holiday season, that could be an episode too. Books and, you know, whatever, Western-themed soaps.
I love it. That'd be a great one. Okay, then. I think it's time we kick things off with Andrew's interview with author Henry C. Park. And right after that, we'll bring you my discussion with author Corey Everett.
Our guest today is Henry C. Park. Henry is well known in Western circles as the film and TV editor for True West magazine, a position he's held since 2015, and from his many, many DVD and Blu-ray commentary tracks. He also blogs regularly for the website of this podcast's favorite TV channel, INSP. The occasion for today's interview is the publication of Henry's new book, The Greatest Westerns Ever Made and the People Who Made Them, a collection of over 70 essays and interviews on a broad range of topics, from classic films and television series to actors, directors, and writers known and overlooked, to the representation of American Indians and women in the Western. Henry, welcome to How the West Was Cast.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
I was joking before we started the interview that I like these where I get to turn the tables and ask questions of the person who is usually in the position of asking questions. So maybe we'll start with a little bit of background on you. You started out not as a film critic or historian, but a filmmaker. You went to film school at NYU and then were a working screenwriter for a long time.
That's right.
So can you tell us a little bit about your journey?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Well, I've always thought of myself as a screenwriter primarily. I wrote my first feature-length script when I was 13. So I always knew this is the real irony, is that I always wanted to be writing movies and hopefully directing. Hasn't happened yet. But my real focus was not even on Westerns particularly, but films noir and comedies. I always loved Westerns, but I always thought I didn't have the historical background to write them until I learned that most of the people who wrote them had less historical background than me. Yeah. So I was with the Young Filmmakers Foundation as a teenager, then went to NYU Film School. My last year in college, I wrote a car crash film that became Speed Trap, Jo Dawn Baker, Tyne Daly. I wrote her first part as a policewoman. And I wrote a film noir called Double Cross with Patrick Bergen, Jennifer Tilly, and Kelly Preston. And in fact, worked in an awful lot of positions other than screenwriting. I've been, a cameraman, dolly grip, Foley artist, sound effects editor. And in fact, I think that's one thing that is sort of an advantage to me as I come to film criticism as somebody who has done a little of an awful lot of the jobs. So I think I approach it a little differently.
Right.
But the way I became the Western specialist is that I was always finding out about film festivals like on the last day and missing things. And so in 2010, it seemed to me that every other genre I liked was getting a great presence on the internet, but Westerns weren't, because essentially it's very hard to balance a laptop on a saddle horn. I think Western people are really, at least back then, were very anti-technology. And so I started my blog, which was Henry's Western Roundup, to keep track of things like film festivals and what films were showing on which channels and things like that. And so I just started blogging about that, and quickly I started getting spaghetti Western actors contacting me wanting to talk about their work, and it just sort of grew from there. So I went from there to being the first writer invited to join the Western Writers of America just for electronic writing. They actually had to change the rules to let me in, and went from there to True West magazine, and that's how it all sort of came about.
Where then does the love of Westerns come from, aside from the insecurity of feeling like you needed to know about Western history to write Westerns, which we know, of course, nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, did you grow up with a Western? Do you have fond memories of Western TV or film?
Oh, yes, very much so. I was born in 54, so I was watching Westerns at a time when there were like 30 different primetime Westerns on TV all the time. So I grew up watching Gunsmoke and Bonanza and Have Gun Will Travel. And my first Western hero absolutely was Roy Rogers. I was just crazy about him and went to the movies. And, it was a time when you look forward to the next John Wayne movie, the next Randolph Scott movie. They're still doing them. I was, as I said, I always loved them. I just hadn't really thought that I was the guy who could make them yet. And of course, I still haven't. I've got a lot of scripts, but haven't made any yet.
I mean, I was going to ask you about that. So, I know every working screenwriter has a drawer full of scripts. Did you ever have a Western that got, any interest, anything close to production?
Yeah, I did actually. It was for a miniseries, and
okay.
I'm a little afraid to talk too much about it because I'm about to make another pass with it.
Oh, okay.
Because, as you know, there's a lot more interest in television Westerns and such now than there was, say, 10 years ago.
Yeah. So, without going into too much detail, when was it conceived? Was it like in the Lonesome Dove moment?
No, this one was probably about 15 years ago.
Okay.
And one of the nice things about not only Westerns, but any period film that you want to do is that it doesn't date the same way as a contemporary script. Right. Things that I wrote that were contemporary 15 years ago, I wouldn't dream of showing anyone today.
Okay. Well, I look forward to having you back in the future where we can talk about your Western miniseries.
I'd love it.
Let's talk about the book. An obvious challenge with a book like this is what to include and what to exclude. So you've written a lot for True West since 2015. So how did you go about selecting the pieces that you wanted to include in the book?
Well, I wanted to use things that would be relevant to people reading it today.
Okay.
And so there were certain articles that I was very pleased with in the past about, say, art direction on various, recent Western series. And I thought, this is great, but these aren't being shown anymore. So there was a lot of that kind of thing that got eliminated. Actually, what I was really happy about was that I thought it made sense to do things like The Sun and Hell on Wheels, which, are fairly recent and quite good shows. And in the past, you would have dropped those just saying, well, nobody can see those. The great thing is with all the streaming services, these really are still current shows. They're still available. I eliminated things that were based on specific events, film festivals and things like that. So it was basically honing down the things I liked the best. Actually, to me, the real interesting change going from the magazine articles to the book was that when you write for a print magazine, you have certain limitations just on space. When they say this has got to be 800 words or 1,200, they're not saying roughly. They're saying you better not have 30 words more. And so inevitably, there is stuff that you have to cut that is good, but you just don't have the choice. And when I went back to edit the articles, cut out references to stuff that was too contemporary or, put in the proper context, I suddenly realized, hey, I can start putting these stories back that had to be eliminated. So even if you had read all of the articles in True West, most of them have material you would not have seen before.
Yeah, I actually went back and checked in some cases. I mean, it was interesting to me. It's kind of like a case of, where you're going from kind of film criticism or journalism in a way to film history, where, time and hindsight gives you better perspective on, what actually does, as you said, stand the test of time. Now, with that said, one thing I found kind of interesting about the book was who and what wasn't in there. Not a lot of John Wayne, not a ton of Clint Eastwood, not a lot of John Ford, Sergio Leone, The Searchers, Shane, High Noon, they're there, but none of them gets their own dedicated section, which might surprise people picking up a book called Greatest Westerns. Now, I thought this was a great thing because it seemed like an attempt to broaden our conception of what we mean when we say greatest Westerns beyond the usual suspects. Am I reading too much into that, or was that part of your thought pattern?
No, that absolutely was a part of my thought pattern. And I very much wanted to look at films that I thought were terrific that don't get the attention. And also, of course, just the fact that although, say, Stagecoach is, I think, the only or one of the few John Ford films that I focus on, a specific chapter, John Ford is in it throughout. John Wayne is in it throughout. There's lots and lots of references. It was just a matter of, when I was writing the magazine articles, I would be focusing on particular ones. I really tried wherever possible to interview people that were still around and still, involved. And so that limits me because, I would have liked to have had more say about spaghetti Westerns. But the fact is, I thought a terrific interview with Franco Nero.
Yes.
And he's very hard to get. So that I was thrilled to get that. And unfortunately, there aren't that many people that are available that were involved with those films today.
No, I mean, to me, that's one of the great things about the book is, we know there's lots of places you can go to hear about John Ford. But, picking up a book that has Greatest Westerns in large font on the cover and, seeing Wes Studi and Franco Nero and so many of the great character actors depicted, you know, sections on kind of second generation actors like Patrick Wayne. You know, you're not going to get that in the kind of the standard history of the Western.
The 100 greatest Westerns kind of books.
Well, exactly. So that means, you know, for readers, there are many, what I would call delightful surprises throughout the book. And I don't want to spoil them, but there's one I have to ask you about. And that is your inclusion of Old Yeller in a chapter on classic Western. So we go right from Stagecoach to Old Yeller. So, you know, tell me about that. I mean, were you expecting any kind of pushback on Old Yeller?
No, actually, not. Yours is the first sort of shocked reaction I've had on that.
Okay.
And again, it was a thing that I think it's a good Western. It is, you know, unusual being so much from children's point of view. But I thought that one of the real advantages was that I still could, well, Tommy Kirk is gone now, but I got to talk to him. I got to talk to Beverly Washburn. And, you know, I thought that provided a real nice look into that particular movie in detail and also what it was like making Disney Westerns.
Right. And as we know, Disney made a ton of Westerns for family audiences and young audiences in the 50s. I will stand by my delightful shock at seeing Old Yeller immediately follow Stagecoach. I think that's actually impressive.
It's Dorothy McGuire and Bess Parker in Walt Disney's outstanding Western adventure of an unusual frontier family and a remarkable Old Yeller dog. See Walt Disney's Old Yeller.
Were there any other especially neglected or overlooked Western, you know, films or actors or filmmakers that you really felt like this needs to be in the book? I need to get this down so that it's kind of preserved.
Outlaw Josie Wales is one
okay.
that I love, and I think it's a terrific film. And it is seems to me one of the least discussed of the Eastwoods, and I think it's one of his very best.
I especially like that. I'm glad you mentioned that. I really like Josie Wales. I would go so far as to say it's Eastwood's best Western. But I agree that it doesn't maybe get the attention it deserves. Do you have a thought of why that might be?
You know, it doesn't fall, I think, under the heading of most of what people think of with Eastwood. They think of spaghetti Westerns, and they think of the ones that he directed that were deeply affected by spaghetti Westerns. But it was kind of a different story. And what I find so odd is that I think that is one of the most imitated movies of Eastwood's canon. And they only imitate the first half. Everyone imitates all the revenge stuff, and they drop it at the point where he gets, you know, to see there's more to life than revenge. And it's like, let's remake this without hope.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, completely erasing the fact that he establishes a surrogate family, and it suggests that the Western hero can, in fact, I mean, there is hope for someone like Shane, I suppose, in a way. That's a really interesting point. Maybe that says more about what we want the Western to be than anything.
Right. I was thrilled to be able to get Sandra Locke to talk about that film.
Yeah.
And she was not immediately very interested in doing the interview, but the way I got her was it turned out that while she was making The Gauntlet with Clint in Phoenix, I had written a picture called Speed Trap, a car chase film, and we were all at the same Ramada Inn. And I reminded her of some weird incidents that happened during the filming. And then she's, oh, it's like, you know, so like, I kind of know who you are. And so then she gave me the interview, but that came in very handy.
When did you talk to her? So this is long after her and Eastwood are, of course, no longer a thing.
Oh, yes. Gosh, I'm thinking like maybe 2 years before she died.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it had been a while. Well, it's a real digression, but one time we were all at the bar at the Ramada, and so Joe Don Baker and his crew are there, and Clint Eastwood is there, and Oliver Reed is there because he's shooting a picture, Assault on Paradise. I think it came out as Maniac. So you come to this crummy Ramada, and there's, you know, three leading men there and all these other people. It was very unusual. And this girl came up to Clint Eastwood and asked him for his autograph. And he'd been signing autographs. They'd all been, you know, all over the place. So she hands him a pen and he reaches and she doesn't have any paper. And she says, no, sign my arm. And he shrugs and he writes Clint on her arm. And the next day, whatever the Phoenix newspaper is, on the front page is a picture of the girl showing that because she'd gone straight to a tattoo artist and had it etched into her arm. And Clint was so horrified at that, he didn't sign another autograph the entire rest of the time he was in Arizona.
Time magazine called it one of the 10 best pictures of the year. He's an army of one.
A man like Wales lives by the feud.
He'll have to run for it now. And hell is where he's headed.
An all-time classic western. Clint Eastwood is the outlaw Josie Wales, rated PG.
I did want to ask about another, you know, kind of exclusion. If there's one Western movie that true West readers clearly can't get enough of, it's got to be Tombstone. Sometimes feels like every other month's cover is one of the characters from the film, including a recent issue celebrating the 30th anniversary. Yet Tombstone is another one of those films that, you know, it doesn't get its own section. It's not in your chapter on the classics, although Lonesome Dove and Dances with Wolves are. It's not in new Westerns where Dead Man is. So, you know, what gives? How can the editor of True West not give their readers their daily dose of Tombstone?
Well, I do apologize. There are a lot of references to Tombstone.
There are a lot of references.
The book, but the fact was, I didn't write any straight-on articles about Tombstone. So I didn't have one to pick from. They had, you know, so many written by other people before I came along.
Yeah.
And somehow, unconsciously, I dodged that bullet. You know, it's an unusual way to do a book where you're not writing it from the beginning,
yeah,
but working from a sort of resource of articles that I had done in the past. If I was going to sit down and write a book and foolishly call it the greatest Westerns ever made and the people who made them, but write it from scratch, it would be a different book. So I was working from the materials that I had already done, and it was omitted at that level, really. It was not something I decided not to include. It was something that I hadn't really written about a direct article.
Yeah, I've just given you a hard time.
I appreciate that.
I mean, I guess I should ask, do you have a explanation or a thought about Tombstone then and about why it, you know, kind of really more than almost any other Western, I think, released over the past 30 years, has kind of occupied the thoughts of Western fans to such a degree?
You know, it's a fascinating question. I mean, I think it's a very fine movie, but at the same time, I can't say it's my favorite Western.
Of course.
It's very good, but there is something about the sense of family within the Earps that I think touched a deep note in an awful lot of people. But it is a unique film for the response to it, because it is closer to a religion than any other film I can think of. You know, people do quote it chapter and verse.
Yeah.
It is a great script.
Yeah, I've described it different places as kind of like it's really a cult film for Western fans in terms of that participatory nature. Now, it may not quite be, you know, Rocky Horror, but as you said, it's pretty close to that in some respects. That emphasis on the family, that's interesting to me. I saw a funny meme on Instagram the other day, and it was something to the effect of man with depression prescribed watching Tombstone as a cure or something like that.
It does make you feel better. It's true.
One film that does not really come up in the book, and I have to ask about this, is the other Wyatt Earp Western, Wyatt Earp, starring Kevin Costner. Any thoughts on that film?
Of course, I do talk with Kevin Costner about it in the book.
You do, yes.
You know, I think it's a terrific movie. You know, it's the endless battle of which is the better Wyatt Earp movie that came out that week. It's funny. Every time I think of that, I think of the opening shot in the saloon. I just love those saloon doors. I know that's not what you're asking, but I think that both Tombstone and Wyatt Earp are really fine films. But I also think that so much has been written about them that I really didn't, you know, feel the need to devote more to them. because I don't think there's a lot more that I could say about them that hasn't been said before. That's one thing that I really wanted to get away from, you know, in my article writing and then in the book, was to not overcover things that have been covered to pieces.
Yeah, no, I agree. I don't know if we really need another article about Shane, for example, or even the Searchers. You know, I wish Matt was with us, because he could make a strong case that there is a lot more to say about Wyatt Earp, and that maybe the Kevin Costner's forthcoming epic Horizon is going to be the prompt to get us to reevaluate that film as the masterpiece that he would claim it to be. But yeah, I guess we'll see. So you've mentioned that you've had the opportunity to interview so many, you know, really interesting and talented people. Again, as I joked before, seems like almost everyone extant who's made a Western show or a movie. Do you have a favorite actor or filmmaker that you've spoken with about Westerns? You
know? Gosh, my favorite interviews were probably Bruce Dern and Robert Duvall.
Oh, okay.
They were just terrific. Bruce Dern, the funny thing that, because I've interviewed him a couple of times, and the first time I was doing an article on the Cowboys, and in the midst of writing it, the phone rang, and the man on the other line just starts talking very fast, and I didn't catch it. I said, "I'm sorry, who's this?" And he says, "This is Henry Park." And I said, "Yeah." And he says, "And you're doing an article on the Cowboys?" I said, "Yeah." And he says, "This is Bruce Dern. What do you want to know?" And, you know, somebody that I had mentioned that, you know, to that I was working on this article and that I would love to talk to him, knew somebody who worked for him. And it came around full circle, and he called without, you know, the slightest warning. And I was so glad that I was so into the article that I knew what I wanted to ask him, because I'm somebody that does hours of preparation. I never call anyone to try and set up an interview without being completely prepared to do the interview that minute. Because sometimes, as you know, people will say, "Yeah, what do you want to know?"
What would you say is more a philosophical question, is the biggest misperception people have about the Western as a genre of movies and television?
Well, I think that probably that people think that they're sort of simple-minded shoot-em-ups.
Huh.
That it's mostly just about a lot of action. And action is important. But to me, Westerns are mostly about the pioneer experience and the individual and the idea that an individual can make a difference. And I think that comes through in, you know, any good Western, but it's something that people who don't pay attention to the genre don't get.
I think that's really true. I've said many times on this podcast that, you know, the Western was great, not because it was simple, but because it was complex, and not because it just did one thing that appealed to all people, but because it, you know, told a story that could speak to many people in different ways. And I think, you know, as we've been saying, I think your book is a testament to that, because it's recovering a lot of this kind of complexity. What's your take on the state of the Western in 2024? I've certainly been interviewed for a lot of the Western is back articles. You know, given your perspective on all of this, what do you think? Are we in a moment of Western resurgence? Is that overblown? What do you make of the Western today?
I think we are in a period of Western resurgence. The odd thing is, it seems to me that an awful lot of the better stuff is being done for television rather than the theater, which is too bad, because no genre is better for seeing on a big screen than the Western. I would say, for instance, I think 1883 is the best television Western since Lonesome Dove.
Oh, that is high praise.
It is. And believe me, I've thought a lot about it before saying it, but, you know, I think that there is some really wonderful work being done. I find the irony is that Westerns are now done either with insane amounts of money or virtually none at all. Was Walter Hill's recent film Dead for a Dollar is a nice film. It's nicely done, but it is done for a budget. And, well, that's why he dedicated it to Bud Bedeker. because it sort of echoed the kind of things that he did with Randall Scott for so little money. But I think it's weird that there is no middle ground, that either these things have to be made for on a credit card or the insane amounts of money that are spent on comic book movies.
Right. I suppose that sets us something of a dangerous precedent where you either have to be working on that shoestring budget or you need to have a ton of money. I hadn't thought of it in that particular way, but that certainly makes sense. You know, we're talking on the day when the trailer for Kevin Costner's Horizon has just been released, and there is no probably bigger budget Western maybe in history in some ways than that particular film in terms of expense, scope, all of that. And yes, that is a very different film than Dead for a Dollar or, you know, Old Henry or these sort of films that character actors want to be in because they see the opportunity, not because they're going to be cashing a big paycheck.
But because it's a good role. Yeah.
Sort of on that note, there's a couple of people I wanted to ask you about that I was really pleased to see in here. So one of them is Trace Adkins, who is in some ways one of the biggest Western stars of the past, gosh, almost 20 years now, but largely in films, with a few exceptions, that have gone direct to, you know, direct to DVD, direct to streaming. So what did you make of Trace Adkins as a Western star?
I like Trace, and he is not a trained in-depth kind of an actor. He is obviously a singer who has sort of drifted into it, doing small supporting parts and things like The Lincoln Lawyer, and somebody got the smart idea of letting him be a villain in Westerns and working his way up to hero, which is, it's sort of like the kind of the Buck Jones kind of thing. He is
right
pretty close to being the kind of guy that he plays, except he doesn't kill a lot of people in real life. but Trace is, I find him fascinating, particularly in terms of his role in films, because as far as I know, he is the first star to become a big Western star through direct-to-home video films.
I think that's right. I mean, certainly we've seen a lot of stars who are maybe on the wane, like Lou Diamond Phillips or Val Kilmer, Kris Kristofferson at some points, you know, look to lower-budget direct-to-streaming Westerns. But you make an excellent point that he is actually kind of rose up through those ranks and made it to supporting roles in films like Old Henry.
He's authentic.
Well, and a really striking physical presence, too. He's just so, you know, large, and he has such a deep voice. He's just such a distinct performer.
Oh, my wife is always saying to me that she always thought I had a deep voice until I started interviewing Trace Adkins. Then I sound like, you know, the Lullaby League.
A senseless killing.
Anyone see anything?
Spot Kennedy was around.
Will set the West's greatest lawman on the trail of a ruthless killer whose family operated above the law.
You fear retribution from his father.
Sean Roberts.
We can't give up now.
Matt Dallas.
Gonna make it right.
Trace Adkins.
My God, what have you brought upon us?
And Val Kilmer.
That's what we set out for. No turning back.
Wyatt Earp's Revenge.
Two questions to wrap up, where I'm going to ask you to name some films for people to watch. First question, you know, instead of the standard, what's your favorite Western? I wanted to ask you if you could recommend sort of one or two Westerns that you would recommend to folks to get them excited about the Western. So we have lots of listeners who love Westerns, but, you know, you're kind of like an evangelist for the Western in some ways, I feel like. So what films might you recommend to get people excited about the Western as a kind of entry point into it in 2024?
The first thing that comes to mind, well, I'll just say it. How about the original, not the remake of The Magnificent Seven? So many solid actors and such a compelling story. So that's one comes to me right off.
Which is in the book. So you can read more about Magnificent Seven in the book.
One that I really don't touch much on, I think, in the book, but is a terrific film and might be a good entry-level thing, is Red River. An awful lot of times people look at Westerns as strictly guy entertainment, and I think that that is one that so many women have told me is a favorite, and yet it is not like a, quote, girl Western or anything like that.
I think those are great choices. I think The Magnificent Seven is actually, I've had a lot of success showing it in my classes because it's actually seems contemporary. The idea of you assemble a team of diverse talents to achieve a particular goal, and then there are, you know, twists and turns along the way, and there's a eternal question of who's going to live and who's going to die. So it's kind of archetypal, at least for many contemporary viewers in that sense. And I like the recommendation of Red River, and you know, certainly that we get the Hoxian woman in there. No feathers, of course.
Oh yes. Yes, and I think Rio Bravo is a wonderful choice. I always found it fascinating that so many people think you have to choose between High Noon and Rio Bravo.
Oh. Yeah, you don't have to choose. Why not both?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I would want El Dorado in that mix too. I would hate to have to give up any of those films. Rio Lobo, maybe.
It's John Wayne in one of his biggest Western adventures as a gang of carpetbaggers runs riot through a Texas town until they pick on trouble their own size. But even Wayne can't win them all.
Are you connected with the sheriff's office?
Well, no, I...
Please stay out of this.
See Big John Wayne at his best in Rio Lobo next Saturday at 9, 8 Central Time, right after The Bionic Woman on NBC.
So, okay, so we've got a couple of entry points. With all the perspective you've gained from compiling a book called The Greatest Westerns, I'm going to ask you to do a little bit of prognostication. There are some sort of more contemporary things. As you mentioned, The Sun is in here. There's a great recent television series. But I'm wondering if there's, you know, if you were to write the next edition of this book in, say, you know, 10 years, what other films, television shows would you imagine would be included in as a great Western?
Oh gosh, I'm going blank on the one I liked a lot with Clint Howard, and he's not the lead, but I interviewed him about it. The Old Way with Nicolas Cage.
Great choice. Yeah, Nicolas Cage seems to be entering his Western phase.
I like that a lot. I liked Old Henry a lot. The odd thing is that most of these that I'm saying are pretty dark, and when you look at John Ford's films, Howard Hawks' films, Bud Bedeker's films, there was always a balance of very serious drama and life and death struggle and humor. And a lot of films of late would give you the impression that there was no humor in the West, that everything was just so life and death, that it takes a lot of the fun out of it. I think, actually, what was I just watching? News of the World really kind of surprised me about how good it is. And it's one of the few very recent Westerns that not only I think would be of interest to a kid, but is appropriate for them to see. And I worry that we're not going to have future generations watching Westerns if we don't have something that they can enjoy when they're young.
Right. No, that's a great point. I sometimes worry that over the past 30 years or so, the Western has started to take itself very seriously because critics have started to take the Western more seriously than they had in earlier generations. And so sometimes I think there's just this attempt to almost self-consciousness about, you know, this is the way it was. This was very serious. It was life or death. The stakes are huge. Almost a kind of pretentiousness can sometimes enter Westerns, especially big screen Westerns today. So I think that's great. That's great advice, actually, to keep in mind that if we want to keep watching Westerns, we need to make sure we get the folks while they're young. All right. Well, last thing, Henry, anything on the horizon for you that we should know about? You obviously have a lot on your hands. What's next for you? Anything interesting in the pipeline?
As far as what I'm doing, this is my first book. So I'm really learning as I go along. So there are a couple of more books that I would like to do in the near future about Westerns. And I've, as I told you before, there's another script that I want to make another pass at now that I think the timing is better. But I'm, you know, sort of open to whatever comes. Because in the words of Charles Foster Kane, that's right, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just trying everything I can think of.
Well, for somebody who doesn't know what he's doing, you're certainly doing a great service to the Western. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say you're probably, you know, you and maybe Mr. Joyner are doing more than anybody else to keep the spirit of the Western alive. And it's books like yours that are reminding us of just how rich and exciting the history of the genre was. So I Matt and I tip our hats to you.
Thank you so much. And just for anyone who doesn't know, as long as you mentioned my buddy, there's C. Courtney Joyner is a, you know, wonderfully talented filmmaker and writer about Westerns and screenwriter. And we've done about 30 commentaries together on Westerns.
Yeah, two wrote together, clearly. Well, Henry, this has been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us on How the West Was Cast.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a great time.
Right now, I'm joined by Corey Everett, the writer and creator of the acclaimed My First Movie children's book series, which is part of the popular Little Cinephile brand. These are beautifully designed picture books that take young readers on a journey through movie history, and they're guaranteed to please grown-up fans as well. Each book in the series covers a unique genre, from film noir to Italian horror films to the French New Wave. Now, Corey has just released an exciting second volume of books, and the titles in this new collection include My First Hollywood Musical, My First Yakuza Movie, and the one we're going to talk about today, My First Spaghetti Western. This is a delightful book, and it's one that listeners of this podcast will definitely appreciate. Corey Everett, welcome to How the West Was Cast.
Hey, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
So, before we talk about this adorable book, I want to get your thoughts on the Western movie genre more broadly. So what's your relationship like with Westerns in general? Are you a big fan of the genre, more of a casual viewer? How would you put your relationship with Westerns?
I'm a big fan. I think considering my age and when I grew up, I was born in the early 80s, so kind of a fairly dormant time for the genre. And so kind of coming of age in the 90s, there wasn't a whole lot to grab onto, but I will say there were a few early ones. Tombstone in particular, the Kurt Russell, Val Kilmer, George P. Cosmatos directed film, which just had an all-star cast, I think was the first contemporary one that I saw basically, you know, when it was released to home video and immediately loved and kind of became a part of the collection. And then, you know, I'm sure I saw Unforgiven in high school, maybe a few years after it came out, and loved that. And then it was really when I was in college and kind of teaching myself film history by going over the AFI Top 100 list or the Entertainment Weekly list or the Sight and Sound list and kind of cross-referencing and just trying to fill in the gaps of all these classic films I'd never seen. And as I was doing this and just watching dozens and dozens of movies, the Western was one of my favorite genres, like reliably. And one of the things I liked about it is that it is so elastic, that it can do so many different things.
Do you have a favorite era of Westerns now that you've kind of educated yourself on the genre? I know that I always break them down into those, like, the classic period of the 30s and 40s, the Technicolor of the 50s, then you get the gritty 60s, 70s revisionist stuff, and the modern prestige Westerns. Where do you put on if you really just want to kind of go back to the old West? What era do you tend to turn to?
That's a tough one. I don't know if it's an era so much as just a few of the titles. So I would say more like some of my absolute favorites. I mean, obviously the spaghetti Westerns. So going through the Dollars trilogy, watching Leone, you know, get a little bit bigger, a little bit grander, a little bit more ambitious with each film. And just when you get to, you know, The Good and the Bad and the Ugly, and you think, well, it cannot get any more epic than this, you know, sprawling Civil War, 3 hours, you know, bigger, bolder, weirder. And then he tops himself with Once Upon a Time in the West. And so it's like the Spinal Tap, like these go to 11. It's like he finds another gear just when you think, oh, Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, a perfect film, you know, 4 stars. And it's like, no. Once Upon a Time in the West, it's like they added the 5th star just for this movie to go. There actually is something even more transcendent, even more epic. So absolutely those movies, I remember in a different gear, a couple of the Howard Hawks westerns. I really loved Red River, which was kind of like, for me, The Searchers didn't hit as much, but Red River was my like kind of darker than I expected western with John Wayne. And Rio Bravo is just the absolute delight from beginning to end. I just got a chance to see that at the TCM Film Fest.
Oh, nice. Was Angie Dickinson there?
She was there, still amazing with it. And yeah, so that was great to see that. And then, yeah, and then you go into like the Butch Cassidy or the Wild Bunch, the kind of getting a little bit playful or a little bit darker, you know, the late 60s, early 70s. So I would say the broadest answer is between the late 50s and the early 70s. So that 15-year run, I would probably grab for something in there.
So turning now to your My First Movie book series, how did the series come about? Like, what's the origin story behind My First Movie? It's such a fascinating idea. It seems like one that somebody should have done a long time ago. And I'm glad you're the one who did it because you just nailed it.
Yes, you hit it on the nose. I mean, I had done this card game called Cinephile, which we had done a Kickstarter campaign for and then kind of gotten funded, which came from the same place of, I can't believe nobody's made this game yet. I'm going to make it. And then as soon as that was up and running, I had a son and basically started looking around for stuff for film nerds like me who had young kids. And there was some stuff out there, but there wasn't really as much as I had hoped. And there were a few kind of no-brainer ideas that I just couldn't believe nobody had done yet. The first was an alphabet book of directors. And so we made that. That was our first book called A is for Auteur, written by me and illustrated by Steve Isaacs, the incredible illustrator who also did the card game. And then after that, the idea was for this My First Movie series, which was just basically a slightly more children's book style, colorful board book, very simple, you know, read it and it rhymes and just great colorful artwork. Basically, each one focusing on a very specific subgenre or time period of film. The first idea that came to me was probably the widest gap between what's appropriate for kids and what you would make a children's book out of, which was the My First Giallo Horror, which was just the idea just kind of cracked me up. And just the creative challenge of trying to be true to what that genre is, you know, which is lurid and, you know, violent, but kind of do it in a way that is still appropriate for a children's book. And I think the humor and the tension between those two things was really kind of what lit that creative spark. And so I knew it wasn't a standalone, that it had to be part of a series. And so the idea was basically to start a series. And so last year, we put out My First Movie Volume 1, which is a little box set of the first three volumes, which was My First Giallo Horror, My First French New Wave, and My First Film Noir. And then this year, we're back with three more, which, as you said, is spaghetti westerns, Yakuza movies, and Hollywood musicals. And the illustrator on these, she lives in France. Her name's Julie Olivi. And now we've done six books together and we're about to start the next three. So it's been a great collaboration. She's a huge movie lover. And so it's kind of a dream project for both of us.
At what point in the project did you know you wanted to cover spaghetti westerns for one of the titles? Did that come after the first three came out, or did you already have that in mind early on?
For some reason, Giallo and French New Wave were the first two that came to mind, and I was trying to come up with a third to round them out. My wife had suggested film noir, and I thought, oh, that's perfect. And as soon as those made sense as a set, I thought spaghetti westerns. And the reason spaghetti westerns over just westerns is I think creatively the books are the most successful when they're specific. And so there are plenty of genres of film that I love that I can't really see doing in this book style because there's just not the same uniform visual style. Like, I love 80s action movies, but they all don't really look the same. You know, it's like different directors have different styles. There's not one look that I think you would instantly gravitate towards. And similarly with westerns, it's like you can go to the 30s and 40s. You could take black and white. You can take Rio Bravo Technicolor, you know, Leone widescreen. Like, they're all so different that I think the more specific you are, the more successful they are. And so I just thought spaghetti westerns being just so visually distinct that it would easily lend itself to this book.
Mm-hmm. So I want to talk a little bit about the actual process of writing my first spaghetti western. The book, as you kind of mentioned, is basically a series of rhymes. So what's the initial step? Do you start by just like listing phrases and words that bring to mind spaghetti western and then start mixing and matching them with each other? What's your process like?
Yes, is the answer. Is I basically give myself a little bit of a deadline. So I'll try and work on getting a draft of a book in a month. And so during that month, what I do is try to immerse myself in that genre. And so I believe it was January of this year, I started with spaghetti westerns. And so what I'm doing is I'm buying a couple books on spaghetti westerns. I'm kind of looking through those and I'm revisiting spaghetti westerns that I love, you know, that I maybe haven't seen in a while, and trying to dig a little deeper and watch some new ones that I haven't seen yet. And so while I'm doing all this, yeah, I'm jotting down words and just like a long list of words, phrases, imagery. And then from there, I start trying to pair them up in a rhyme in a way that makes sense. And what I tried to do with the spaghetti western book and with several of these books is basically tell a kind of overarching story when you're reading the book that maybe isn't apparent immediately, but is kind of there subliminally. And so for the spaghetti westerns book, I want the final text not just to be a word cloud of things that rhyme, okay, is I'm actually telling the story of a western film. And so basically the movie opens with this widescreen vista, this big open landscape. And if you follow the pages, you see a silhouette of a guy on a horse who kind of rides into this town from behind, this one horse town. And then you kind of meet this colorful cast of characters in the town. It ends in a shootout, and it kind of, at the very end of the book is the great silence. And so the idea is basically there's this shootout at the finale and then this kind of metaphoric fade to white of death, the afterlife, all of these things. And so you may think, well, this is insane because you're talking about a children's book, but for a movie fan like myself, this is the level of detail I really do try to put into these things. So where if you're reading this with a toddler, they're just like colorful pictures, this is cool, and it will genuinely teach them about the genre. But if you are the grown-up reading this to them or just enjoying it yourself as a fan of this genre, I do try to build that stuff in there. And so for the Westerns, it's really telling a loose story of someone coming into town, having the shootout, and dying at the end. And for Hollywood musicals, for instance, I try and start with Busby Berkeley, take you through, you know, the Technicolor 50s, and then the book ends with Cabaret, which is kind of like, here's the end of the classic Hollywood musical and the beginning of this new thing. And the very last page is, you know, Liza Minnelli, you know, in Cabaret, the daughter of Judy Garland, who's at the beginning in Wizard of Oz. And so it's kind of, I'm trying to build in these layers into these books because why not?
That's a great, great concept. There's a real musical quality to these books that I appreciated. My favorite three-line verse in the Spaghetti Western book is the one that goes, "Wordless glances, second chances, the ecstasy of gold." It's like a spaghetti western haiku.
Yep.
That sort of evokes images in such a simple but powerful way. Do you have a favorite passage in one of these books?
The one that always comes to mind is in the Giallo book. And this was the first one that I had written a draft of. And it's the ending of that, kind of in that couplet. So most of the book is kind of A, B rhymes, where you're rhyming on the second and fourth line. But then the end of the book, I really try to build to a little bit of a climax. So where it's one, two, three, one, two, three. And so basically the ending of Giallo Horror always cracks me up, which is piercing screams, psychic dreams, phantasmagoric hues, elaborate set pieces, telekinesis, she gave you all the clues. And I think it's just the challenge of getting telekinesis and phantasmagoric hues in there and having the rhymes just flow perfectly. It's just like, I'm like, that's still kind of the high watermark that I set for myself with all these books, which is just, it's okay if these words go over the kids' heads, but hopefully for an adult, even an adult who maybe isn't as familiar with this genre, it should be fun to read and musical in a way that, you know, if you got this as a gift because you like movies, maybe you don't know spaghetti westerns as well. But after reading this book, you should have a sense of what that genre is.
Oh, that's great. I love that one. It's like, you know, Dr. Seuss meets Mario Bava. It's a very, very fun stanza there.
Yeah, that would be the goal. Absolutely. The highest compliment.
So you mentioned the artwork earlier. So I want to talk about your relationship with the artist, Julie Olivi, I believe her name is. What's that like? Do you make suggestions to her on what you want each of these stanzas to be or what these images to be? You know, is there a lot of back and forth there? Talk about that.
Yes. Yeah, so we have been working together for over 2 years now, and we pretty much are in communication just about every day on WhatsApp, and we have never met in real life, which is insane, and one of the great things of what the internet can do, which is bring people and creative people together in this way. And so I had found her artwork on Pinterest when I was doing research for the Giallo horror book, and she had experience illustrating children's books and had also done these sketches of Dario Argento's Deep Red. And I had saved them and just kept coming back to them and looking at them and going, God, this is really what I need. This, her style of this kind of children's book, colorful, bright, you know, simple shapes, but doing these more adult movies. And she also had done these great postcards of Twin Peaks characters that similarly looked like they could have been drawn out of a children's book and yet perfectly captured the mood, the feeling, the color palette of the David Lynch series. And so after, you know, 6 months to a year of basically staring at these things, I finally reached out to her and said, hey, you know, would you be interested in doing this project together? And she was. And so our working relationship is basically communicating over WhatsApp, occasional Zoom call. And she has a similar process where I take a month to kind of dig into the movies and come back with a draft for her. Is she'll spend the same amount of time digging into the movies herself and then starting to do sketches. And so as an art director, what I also try and provide her with is basically ample reference. And so I will give her a deck, a Google Slides document that has pages and pages of here's the text laid out and maybe a sample image for each page, which is kind of what I was thinking, but she can feel free to go off from there since she's doing her own research. And then I'll have at the back of the draft pages and pages of references of here's what I think it should feel like. And then maybe even a suggested color palette where I'm like, here's what I'm thinking. And then she can take that and refine it and do her thing with it. And then from there, she'll do a couple thumbnail sketches for each page. I'll kind of pick one or give some notes. And then she will go back through once all the thumbnails are done and kind of laid out so we can see how the whole book looks together. And then she'll start doing the finished pieces based off those thumbnails, incorporating any loose notes that I might have. And then from there, it's pretty much, I think at first it was a little more searching on the first set to really find the style. But with the second set, it was really kind of a breeze. The work got better and she was really locked in and just kind of nailing it immediately. And her work was so good that it kind of opened up new possibilities for the series in the sense that I do feel more confident that you can take a genre that maybe is a little more varied visually and she can actually bind it together through the color palette and make it feel of a piece.
Fascinating collaboration there. I think this really, the fact that you haven't met in person says something that you still come up with a book that's this concise and this cohesive. It's pretty impressive. So you recorded an audio trailer for the Spaghetti Western book, actually for each of the books in the series, and it's read by a very unique narrator. So can you explain this wonderful YouTube trailer that you have for these books?
Yeah, so we've done them for all six books, and it's my son Julian, who's 6 years old, basically reading the text of the book, and I'm kind of editing a montage of clips from the actual films underneath him reading the entire book. And because it's a very short book, it's about 40, 45 seconds long. And I just thought this is the most concise way to convey the tone of these books by showing you the films and yet having the kind of child narrator talking through these bigger words. And then at the end, when you see the artwork from the cover, hopefully it immediately conveys the tone and the sensibility of what these are. But I love the trailers. He does a great job. And then I have a younger son, Noah, who's now three, who did very short teasers that we actually just released. I haven't even posted them yet, but basically we got a few amazing blurbs from a couple of filmmakers and actor, and basically having him read their blurbs about the books and then showing the book cover, I thought was similarly funny.
That leads right into the next question that I had, which was, every author, of course, wants those kind of celebrity blurbs. It's just a great calling card. And the fact that you have Samuel L. Jackson, who's starred in some fine Westerns of his own, blurbing your spaghetti Western book. And, what was that like? How did that come about?
Completely unreal. I still can't believe it. It comes from the desperation of trying to make the holiday shipping deadline for these books, which is no matter what the project, it's not Julie, it's not me. It's like whoever I'm working with, whatever the project is, whenever we say we're going to start and finish, it's always we finish 2 months later than that. And then it's always just a race to try and get the thing out by holiday, because that's when the bulk of our sales for the year comes in. And so I think it's great to really have new product out so we can talk about it and they can be on gift guides and that kind of thing. And so between when Julie finishes the artwork and I submit the final files for print, there's about a week in there of a buffer. And that week is me essentially scrambling to try and solicit a few quotes for the back of these books. Because as an independent release, though we do work with Penguin Random House on our card game, the Little Cinephile line is completely independent. And so that means we're doing everything ourselves. So from the conception, design, production, marketing, PR, distribution, all of that is essentially me. So it is a lot of work. And so with the Samuel L. Jackson thing, a few years ago, I believe his niece had reached out to see if he was in our card game, which he is. And so I sent along a t-shirt because his Instagram is him wearing lots of t-shirts with drawings of him on it that he, that different artists have done. And I said, oh, can we send along a shirt? And she said, oh yeah, great. And then about a year later, he followed us on our social media accounts and sent a DM that just said, thanks for the dope ass tee, and posted a picture of himself wearing it on his Instagram. And I thought, oh my God, that's amazing. And I wrote a long thank you paragraph of what, seeing Pulp Fiction meant to me as a, middle schooler, whenever back in the 90s, and then kind of let it go and didn't really think about it. And then during that week long scramble of just trying to figure out who was going to endorse these things, I thought, well, I've never bothered him. It's been a couple years. Let me just DM, because I know for a fact he is a huge cinephile. I know he loves Westerns. I know he loves Yakuza movies. And so let me just say, hey, would you mind, doing this? And he responded, was incredibly gracious, and sent us some incredibly nice blurb for the back of the books. And it's just one of those, like, shoot your shot. You never know what's the worst that can happen thing. And yeah, I cannot express the gratitude and how cool it is to hear something like that from him.
Wow, congrats on that. That was it's great advice for people out there. Take your shot. I love that. So to wrap up, I'm sure you've already been thinking about future volumes. You've got this one coming out now, so there's still a lot of work involved in getting the word out there, but you have to be thinking about that. So without soliciting what you're coming up with next, there are two subgenres that I think would be interesting choices. I'm sure you get this all the time.
All right, let's hear
it. Okay, so the first one I was thinking is my first experimental film. And you cover Maya Deren and Stan Brakhage, Kenneth Anger.
Right.
Is there maybe something there? Is that a little too strange or what?
Well, we do niche stuff, but that is definitely uber niche. Maybe a few volumes down the line. We do actually... We are ahead of schedule this year in that we are starting the next three volumes now. So I know for a fact what the next three are going to be, but if there are any beyond that, yeah, those are still open for solicitation.
Okay. And my last one, if that was too niche, then this one's probably not going to work, which should be my first nunsploitation. I'm a big fan of the nunsploitation genre. Dark Habits, The Other Hell.
Miss 45.
Miss 45, I put that on there.
I just saw for the first time at the Arrow here in LA, and I was pretty blown away by, honestly.
It is a fantastic film. I wrote a piece a couple of years ago for Variety on the – I actually did 20. The 20 creepiest nuns in movies. It was when the first nun Conjuring movie came out.
Yes,
so Miss 45 was on there. You know, Love Letters of a Portuguese Nun, that Jess Franco movie. I'm a big nun exploitation guy. So I'm thinking that might be a little too edgy, right?
No, let me tell you, I have maybe not one better, but I do have a great news for you in the fact that one of the next three movies, which we are doing, it's not nunsploitation, but it is going to be my first midnight movie. And one of the lines in the book literally is nunsploitation. And so there's your exclusive. It's going to be in there. And that will be next year.
Breaking
so
news.
Look forward to
you
it.
You heard it here first.
Yes,
I love
exactly.
It.
So it's kind of – that one will be like cult movies, midnight movies, you know, anything from – Rocky Horror and John Waters to, you know, El Topo to Miss 45, all that kind of stuff. So that
brilliant.
It will make its way in, and that's probably going to be the edgiest one since the Giallo Horror. And that will be coupled with my first Kung Fu movie and my first sci-fi movie. But the sci-fi is just going to be basically 1968 through 1982. So basically 70s with a little bit on either side.
Nice.
Again, trying to focus in and tell a story, which is starting at 68, which is Planet of the Apes, Barbarella, and 2001, all in 1968, and then ending at basically Ridley Scott comes in with Alien and Blade Runner and completely changes the look of science fiction from the white room, bleepy bloopy, you know, Logan's Run to something much different. And so that'll be that one.
I love it. So, Corey, where can listeners order copies of your book? Where can they find you online?
You can find us online at cinephilegame.com and lilcinephile.com, L-I-L, cinephile, or follow us on social media. We also do work with a few partners like the Academy Museum, if you're in Los Angeles, or the Museum of the Moving Image in New York, if you want to swing by and pick up any of these in person. But yeah, go to our website.
To make it easier for everyone, we'll include links to your site in the show notes of this episode so that people can order copies, which I highly recommend they do. Well, Corey, I want to thank you again for joining me on the show today to discuss your charming books. They are just such a fun read for movie fans. You know, I wish my kids had been young enough and when these books came out so that I could have shared them with them. I think I would have done that in a second. So best of luck with the series moving forward. I can't wait to see what you come up with next.
Thanks. Really appreciate it.
Wide screen vistas, desert plains, one horse towns, men with no name, mercenaries, bandoleros, bounty hunters, companeros, grieving widows, setting suns, cemeteries, gatling guns, wordless glances, second chances, the ecstasy of cold, a burst of violence, the great silence, a dish that's best served cold. My first spaghetti western. Coming soon from Little Cinephile.
Well, that wraps up this episode, but before you go, be sure to follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find us at Western Podcast, all one word. Tell us about your favorite Western film books, or suggest another topic that you'd like us to cover on a future episode. As always, if you enjoy our podcast and want to support it, the best way to do that is by subscribing to it on whatever platform you use. Simply click the subscribe button, and you'll never miss an episode. Until next time, I'm Matthew Chernoff.
And I am Andrew Patrick Nelson, and you've been listening to How the West Was Cast.
Well, that was our show. We thank you kindly for listening.
and hope you'll come back again real soon. Till then, keep your saddle oiled and your guns greased. We'll be seeing you.